hit me back.
I wanted him to give me the punishment I craved, so maybe I'd finally sleep at night. Maybe then, things could return to how they used to be between us. But Hassan did nothing as I pelted him again and again. I don't know how many times I hit him. All I know is that when I finally stopped, exhausted and panting, Hassan did pick up a pomegranate. He walked towards me, opened it, and crushed it on his own forehead.
"There," he croaked. "Are you satisfied?"
Then he turned and started down the hill.
Kulvinder Gear is reading The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini. It's abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. Tomorrow, Amir begins his teenage years consumed with guilt. Now, talking of being consumed...
Jay Rayner gets stuffed.
The kind of stuff I like to listen to is people who are just a little too obsessed with their dinner time.
The Foe is fantastic. Spicy, hot, complex, yet unbelievably simple.
When you hear Anthony Bourdain getting very excitable about how other people eat, well, it just makes me hungry, and that's the best sort of food radio.
With further courses from David Sedaris, Keith Floyd and Miles Jupp, Jay Rayner gets stuffed on BBC Radio 4 Extra. Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Will the woman in white reveal Sir Percival's secret? Our Victorian Gothic drama starring Toby Stevens continues in half an hour here on 4 Extra. But now, in today's episode of his memoir, The Music Room, William Fiennes continues to recount his childhood adventures in the castle where he grew up. He also reflects on the life of his elder brother Richard, who suffered from a severe form of epilepsy and from brain damage, which caused unpredictable shifts in his mood. Dan Stevens reads The Music Room.
Weekday mornings, Dad left for work at the Chartered Surveyor's office he'd set up with his friend George Laws. He wore an old tweed jacket, elbows reinforced with pieces of leather, walking briskly up the drive towards the gatehouse arch, a batch of manila folders under one arm, free hand in the pocket of his grey flannel or tan corduroy trousers, worn thin at the knee. He had an office at home, too, a cold, bare room off the west stairs, with a simple bar heater and a map of the estate hanging on the wall behind his desk. He disappeared up there for hours to see to the estate, go over the accounts, respond to inquiries and requests. He wrote letters at an old bureau in the library off the drawing room, a hinged writing surface inset with a square of green cloth, while Mum worked at a heavy Victorian pedestal desk, heaped with papers, a standard lamp between them. She wrote notes about Richard's most recent visit, preparing for a conference with his psychologist, looking up to ask Dad whether Rich woke at 2 or 3 in the afternoon on Saturday, and what it was he'd said when he came round from a seizure. I was 9 years old. The twins were at university. Dad was at work or meeting landowners, farmers and tenants. Mum was showing groups of students and tourists around the house. When I was bored of being on my own, I'd look for Richard. Sometimes I'd find him in a small room off the west stairs, a few steps down into a bedlam of rolled-up rugs and decrepit fishing rods, a carpenter's workbench with screws and clips in the backboard to carry tools. Rich had used a black marker to trace the tools like bodies at crime scenes. Hammer, drill, awl, screwdriver and saw, outlined on the wood. A name above each shape in my brother's rounded handwriting. The workbench had an iron vise, and now I watched Rich fit a piece of scrap wood between the clamps and turn the shiny bar to close them up. Even after the wood was tightly held, he put all his strength into it, forcing the bar round another inch or two, holding his breath, reddening with exertion. The wood seemed to be getting smaller between the clamps, and when he forced the bar again, the whole bench shifted on the floorboard, the awl dropping from its fixture and chinking in a box of nails. Blast! He didn't know his own strength. Often, after he's been aggressive, he's overcome with a terrible remorse. "I'm such a horrible person," he says. He'll keep harping on his guilt, going over his regrets in arias of sorrow that try everyone's patience almost as much as the initial bad behaviour had. Sometimes, when I let people into the house, the doorbell linked by wire to a copper pull, I tell them my brother's at home and that he's got epilepsy. I'm still learning that it's not Richard's epilepsy so much as brain damage and drugs that make him the way he is. But it's my way of saying he's not like other people. My unsophisticated version of a warning I've heard my mother and father give. A way of preparing strangers so they'll not be caught off guard by Richard's unpredictable bullshiness or ingenuous warmth. When Rich was home, there were foil strips of pills on the shelf under the kitchen clock. By now, he was a virtuoso of tablets and capsules. He didn't even need a glass of water. He just chucked them at the back of his throat and flicked his head to dispatch them down. At midday or 1 o'clock, Mum might send me upstairs to see if I could wake him. I carried the task with me like an executive power. I climbed the narrow stone stairs to the door decorated with a plaque on which the words "Richard's Room" were printed beside a Leeds United crest. I'd come up here exploring when Rich was at the epilepsy centre, rifling through drawers and boxes. Rich kept his records in a wire rack on the left-hand window ledge. Richard Clayderman and James Galway albums, Colliery Band collections, live Gilbert and Sullivan recordings. And on the right-hand ledge was a silver turntable with a smoked perspex lid. He's got an alarm clock, a hammer dinging between exterior bells, but the clangour doesn't make a dent in his unconsciousness. Side effect drowsiness spreads through him like embalmer's fluid and seems to weigh him down. I have to prod him hard on the shoulder to make him stir. It's as if he's emerging not from a night's sleep, but from a whole season's hibernation. Each eyelid a stone he has to roll back from the mouth of a cave. "Time to get up, Rich," I say, prodding. "Lunch is ready." When finally he opens his eyes and lifts his head, his face is set in a dark frown. The new day's world an affront he'll have to deal with against his will. Rich was 11 years ahead of me, but I was catching up. We both liked to hit a tennis ball against the span of open wall between the arched kitchen window and the buttress. We'd argue over TV channels or who'd had more time at the tennis wall. He was more than twice my age, in his 20s by now. But we were peers in our enthusiasms, alike in that neither of us could operate independently in the world. We still looked to our parents for permissions and opportunities. But I was starting to recognise the gulf between us. I knew my childhood was a temporary predicament, and that as soon as I was old enough, I'd be able to make my own way. But for Richard, there was no such prospect of loosened constraints, no country of self-determination on the horizon. His childlikeness was indefinite. He was moated in. My friends' houses were warm, compact and efficient. Other children, older and younger, played in gardens on both sides. There were toasted sandwiches, midnight feasts in bunk beds, teenage sisters trying out lipstick, pop music on the radio. When school friends came to visit my house, it didn't occur to me that there was anything unusual about where I lived, anything that needed explaining. At first they'd be unsure how to react, but the novelty of the old was persuasive, and soon they were rushing from one end of the house to the other, enthralled by spiral staircases, battlements, secret doors, swords you could pick up and wield two-handed, cannonballs you could test the weight of, despite the laminated do-not-touch signs propped around them. But at night, my friend's excitement gave way to trepidation. The enclosed darkness was too extensive. Creaking timbers, rattling windows, rogue winds buffeting through roof spaces and flues had new malevolent power. In the next room, suits of armour were stepping down off their stands and moving in a slow, wading gait towards the door. We don't have any ghosts, my mother told groups of schoolchildren. Well, if we do, they're very nice ghosts, because they don't give us any trouble. Rich came home in high spirits, brimming with tenderness, carrying his Leeds hold all up to his bedroom in bounds, two steps at a time. Spotting a heron from the window, he rushed downstairs again to fetch binoculars from the hall cupboard, concentrating as he closed the outer door behind him to avoid abrupt sounds that might startle the bird. The heron stood motionless on the far bank below my treehouse, long yellow bill angled like a dagger at the water. But when Rich raised the binoculars to his face, the heron launched itself upwards, flinging grey-white wings out from its body, each downstroke producing a perceptible surge of lift, as if the heron were hoisting itself into the air by ropes and pulleys. Rich walked to the end of the battlements and stepped out onto the open lawn. The heron had settled again on the far side at the foot of the park, close to a tall hawthorn. "There he is," Rich said, lifting the binoculars. He was smiling, entirely satisfied. Sometimes he disappeared for an hour or more to follow a heron round the moat, coming back inside to report on the bird's whereabouts. "Do you realise?" he asked. "I actually saw him catch a fish." He had his hand on my mother's shoulder. "I actually saw him," he repeated, "through the binoculars. I must be very lucky. He's still there, I should think, if you want to see him. Mum?" "Yes, I think I must be very lucky." Richard's mood could switch abruptly. Mum warned me to stay out of his way. It had been raining all week and the moat was close to brimming its banks. Dad was worried about the water level and wanted to raise the sluice gate so the moat could drain off into the brook. When the rain stopped, I followed him across the lawn to the stable shed, where saws and garden tools hung on nails, an iron bar resting in the far corner, the heavy, rust-covered staff you needed to raise and lower the sluice. We ducked under low yew branches and stood by the sluice gate. Dad fitted the bar to the ratchet and used all his weight to shift it, inch by inch, a whirlpool forming as moat water drained underneath us, the corner scum of leaf mould and duck slurry breaking up as it slid over the lip of the vortex. We walked home. I didn't return the bar to the shed, but brought it into the house and left it leaning in the stone corner of the hall. Richard was in the kitchen. "Where do you think you've been?" he said.
"We've been lifting the sluice gate," Dad replied, "to let some of the moat out into the brook."
"What do you want to do that for?"
"Just in case there's more rain. It's almost flooding, you see."
Rich was frowning darkly, a fight going on inside him. He understands the sense of what's been said, but he can't accept it while another, more dominant self is intent on conflict.
"What good's that going to do?" "Well, it might be a safety valve and stop the moat from flooding."
"Be a what?"
"A safety valve."
"A safety valve?" He repeated the words with scorn. "I don't know what you're talking about." He followed Dad into the kitchen. "I've never heard anybody talk such a load of trash in all my life." Dad didn't say anything. He was at the sink, washing his hands. Richard stood behind him, leaning forward to speak straight into his ear. "Do you hear me? You talk a load of trash." Dad came back out into the hall. Rich followed him. Mum was coming down the spiral staircase. "A load of trash," Rich said again. The phrase had worked into his head and found a groove. "Your husband talks a load of trash." "Remember what we talked about," my mother said, "about good behaviour and holidays?"
"Don't you start."
His temper was coiling.
"Don't you start talking that trash. I've had enough of all that trash. Trash, that's all it is. Trash."
"Come on, Rich,"
Dad said, taking his arm.
"Get your hands off me,"
Rich shouted, rage spilling over. Dad stepped away as Rich wrested his arm free with a violent jerk. The movement swung his whole body round so he faced the stone corner where I'd left the iron bar, and, as if he was simply obeying the movement's logic, he reached out and picked it up in both hands, then turned to face Mum and Dad at the foot of the stairs, lifting the bar up and back as he took one step and then another towards them.
"Some people here just don't know when to keep their mouths shut," he said.
I looked at his hands gripping the bar and saw that he was shaking. Without warning, he swung the bar across in front of him into one of the windows to the left of the stairs, smashed glass falling to the parquet floor. Cold air rushed in as Rich drew the bar back again like a baseball bat and swung it at the second window. For a while, he didn't move, as if the two explosions had shocked the fury out of him. Then he turned towards me and walked back across the hall. I was ready to run, but he set the bar down again in the same corner I'd left it minutes before and drew his right forearm across his nose. "I've never heard such trash in all my life," he said. One afternoon, I saw Dad standing next to the house, his right arm stretched out, palm pressed flat against a buttress. His head dropped. He didn't move. "What are you doing?" I asked. He said he was asking the house for some of its strength.
Dan Stevens continues to read The Music Room by William Fiennes at the same time tomorrow, 2:45. It's abridged by Viv Beebe and produced by Elizabeth Allard.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, it's 3 o'clock. I'm Steve Urquhart with an hour of classic drama, and Toby Stevens stars in the mysterious Victorian Gothic tale of The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. The story continues in a moment. And later we've drama starring Martin Freeman, best known from Sherlock and The Office, as a man who's permanently distressed. Can aromatherapy help him? Find out tonight at 9:15. So now, what is Sir Percival's secret? We might be about to find out, thanks to The Woman in White.
Anne Catherick, the woman in white. She was waiting for me by the lake, waiting to speak to me. She said she had a secret about Sir Percival which would destroy him if the world got to know of it. She would tell me the secret, and then he'd be afraid of me and wouldn't dare to treat me badly. In the past, she said, she's been afraid of him. But now, it seems, she's afraid no more.
The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Dramatised for radio in 4 parts by Martin Wade. With Juliet Aubrey as Marion Halcombe, Emily Bruni as Laura Fairley, Toby Stevens as Walter Hartwright, Jeremy Clyde as Sir Percival, Philip Voss as Count Fosco, and Edward Petherbridge as Frederick Fairley. Episode 3.
My heart, you see. It isn't right. And I haven't long to live, I'm certain. That's why I don't fear him. But before I die, I must try and make atonement.
Atonement? What do you mean?
I let you marry him. That was my sin. I should have stopped you when I was at Limeridge. But I became frightened and I fled so that he wouldn't take me back to the asylum. He can't harm me now, though. And if I tell you the secret and atone for my sin, I might meet your mother in the world beyond. Oh, if only I could be buried with her. If only I could wake up by her side when the trumpet sounds and the graves give up their dead.
Well then, the secret.
Yes. It was because of the secret that he put me in the asylum. My mother knows the secret too. I learned it from her.
Tell me what it is.
No. Not now.
Why not?
I think there's someone watching us. There's someone listening.
But
come here tomorrow. At the same time, alone. I will tell you it then.
Did you try to speak further with her?
Yes, Marianne, I tried, but she refused. She was determined to leave. Do you think she's telling the truth? Do you think there is indeed a secret that Sir Percival is afraid of?
I do. I judge her words by Sir Percival's actions. And by his actions, it's clear he has something to hide. These journeys that he makes, they relate to Anne Catherick and her disappearance. I'm sure of it. He is determined to find her and prevent her from telling what she knows. Well, Laura, I must give you my news now.
Mr. Gilmore has replied to your letter.
He has. Here. You will see that he is highly suspicious of Sir Percival's conduct and is quite positive that you shouldn't sign a document whose contents are kept concealed from you. It should be sent to him first, he says, so that he may advise you.
Good. Then I shall tell Sir Percival so.
Well, Laura, as it transpires, Sir Percival won't be asking you to sign the document.
He won't?
Not for a while, at least.
Why? What has happened?